And it got caught up in the politics of the home builders and the framing of the issue and, frankly, politics that I don't fully understand. But let's be clear. Our priority is not inclusionary zoning in the context of home ownership, suburban home ownership, development. In fact, I don't understand why we're picking a fight with the home builders at all on this issue, since they don't have the same concern about this in the rental market. And so what got through the House, which was a piece of legislation that was cobbled together and faced strong headwinds, in my judgment, did not actually address the question that we have put on the table. And I applaud the Speaker for putting something forward, but it died in the Senate because our amendment, which would have brought it back to the context we care about, which is multifamily rental housing, you know, couldn't carry the day. So I think it's great it's starting in the Senate because we know we have support in the House to move this, and we have a Speaker that said she will. But if we're really serious about this, I think we have to go all in the Senate. And I think there are conversations with senators from different parts of the state that we need to have, respectful conversations about why the sky's not going to fall if we do this and what we mean. Because every time this thing comes up, it gets framed as home ownership and rent control. And the reason it's framed that way is because there is no preemption on inclusionary zoning. The whole conversation has been so screwed up in the public domain. We can impose inclusionary zoning tomorrow. What we can't do is regulate the rents, that because we're preempted from doing that. And so we have to lift that portion of the law, which applies to regulating the rents, and that happens to be housed in something called the prohibition against rent control. So it's very easy to sort of confuse the issue, because that's the connection, that's the legal connection that we have to get to. But I actually believe if we went all in on this the way we've gone in all in on some other things, we could do something in 2016. And I just don't think we have the luxury of waiting.
Bishop. Just a couple thoughts. We were offered, I think, last session, you know, by the home builders, you know, support for a Portland-only approach. We kind of declined it because we felt it was important to have a statewide solution, and I'm not sure whether that really applied to the multifamily rental aspect. It may have just been the single-family home. But I really think that we've got to avoid those rent control words. That's just the kiss of death from my experience last session. And even Andy, in your opening description of this, you talked about the ability to regulate multifamily rents. I really think this is about requiring new housing stock to include affordable units. And I think, you know, I think the rent control going down that lane is going to doom us. It's choice of words. I mean, it's semantics. I think we all get it. But talking about rent control just evokes a lot of powerful lobbyists down there that can just bottle up things, in my assessment.
But Commissioner, don't you agree that we have to have permanently affordable multifamily rental housing, just put it that way, as opposed to saying rent control?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the words.
But the problem, ladies, is that we can, at the point in which we regulate the affordability component, we're running afoul of a prohibition on rent control. That's the straitjacket we're in.
Change that statute.
So we have to, and that's why the last time the legislation tried to balance a number of things, and that's why the Speaker thought putting in sideboards, where we actually craft, the legislation said we can require units and cap the price, essentially cap the price by mandating affordability, but we had to provide some consideration to the developer. So what we were doing is essentially taking the multi-program and mandating it. That's the only difference. It's like having a mandated multi-program where we could mandate that you do it, but we had to provide consideration, and that legislature was trying to define what the consideration was. Well, it's cleaner if we just lift the preemption and have the confidence that we can figure out our own system. But without some tweak on that particular statute, Dan, which, I mean, we can't avoid because it's been what's been determined is blocking us, then we'll just be sued on the basis that we're imposing backdoor rent control, and that's not our goal. That's not our intent here.
So maybe I can clarify one item, which is the starting point for the bill in the Senate will be the amendment we offered in the Senate last time. So we've actually moved and shaped, it's the bill that's going to be introduced in the Senate, is basically the underlying bill that came out of the House during the last session, plus this very narrow piece that basically says, notwithstanding ORS 224, the rent control statute, local governments have the authority on either ownership or rentals for prospective new multifamily developments. So that way it doesn't matter if someone comes for a building permit, whether they're building condos or anything else, that the same program applies. So there's some streamlining. But it's a very narrow exemption, and that will that'll be a starting point for the conversation. The other note, Commissioner Fish, to your point about the affordable housing community and some of the advocates, is that they have now endorsed that approach. So there really was a lot of energy and enthusiasm. Commissioner Saltzman had come down, both the House and the Senate, really just around this for sale idea. And I think we've moved a number of folks in the housing community to understand that in order to address Portland's rental crisis, the bill needs to have more authority given to this council and others to do that. So Housing Alliance and others are putting that bill and a couple of others on their top line list for the 16th session. Again, I think the Senate is still very much, the numbers are still difficult there, and yet I think there could still be a very strong advocacy push to move something. If we can get something out of the Senate, it'll be a lot easier to move something in the out of the House.
And I appreciate that, because there's a 6-vote margin of D to R, but there are two Democrats from Eugene, there's a Democrat from the coast, there's some other people that when it becomes more like rent control and other kinds of things, have some concerns. And I don't think we're going to win the fight in 2016 by just bringing people in and shaming folks and raising our voices. I think we're going to win the fight by having adult conversations with people that really what we're asking for is a much more limited tool than is portrayed by our adversaries. And then I think we have to figure out which fight do we want to fight. And I, for one, would like to get something out of 2016 so we can get to work on this and not be brushed off on the theory that it's inconvenient to have this conversation in 2016. And we will hear from many in leadership that it's inconvenient to have this conversation in 2016.
Thoroughly agree. I have one tactical suggestion / question, which is one thing that I think has been lacking in at least what I've seen in the public discussion is, what's an example of a successful inclusionary zoning that applies to rental housing program in the country that works? And could we actually, I read somewhere that Montgomery County, Maryland has been very successful. If that's true, and that's a model we want to follow, can we bring somebody from Montgomery County out to testify in front of the legislature?
Fairfax County, Virginia also.
That's right. Yeah. It's a great suggestion. And Director Kurt Krieger from the Housing Bureau actually came down and participated a couple weeks ago in front of the House Housing and Human Services Committee and brought some of that information forward and his prior experience working in other markets where this has been done successfully and just providing some information about this has been in place for 25 years and the sky hasn't fallen. That is something, particularly since inclusionary zoning has manifested itself in different parts of the country in a little bit different ways, is we are working on what exactly those examples are so that we can point to successful models and the need is obviously great and the mechanics are definitely a part of this.
Martha, just one more point without beating a dead horse here. In the last 3 years, 22,000 private sector apartments have gone online in our city. Less than 3% are affordable. Last I checked, we have something called market cycles, and we're not going to be in a bull run forever. We're going to overbuild. There's going to be a correction. There may even be an economic correction. The idea that we'd wait till 2017 to get the authority to get to work on something that wouldn't be in effect till 2018, we are now at risk of missing this unique opportunity where on every corner, seemingly, there's a crane. And we don't have a tool other than Dan's goodwill and the more flexible multi-program to get people to, with a cap of $3 million, to encourage developers to do the right thing. And that's why I think we have to make the claim, the argument to leadership that 2016 is the time. I think it has to be one of our two priorities. And I think as a council, we need to be deployed strategically to have those conversations with particularly the critics.
Well, I don't think it's beating a dead horse for us to really focus on this issue, because we have declared a state of emergency. We are all serious about this. We are doing a lot of things. So we have momentum. And then secondly, looking at the rest of this list, although there are things in here that I think are good, frankly, I don't see anything that rises to that level. I'd love for the legislature to do something helpful on climate change, but I don't expect that as much as I expect the possibility, at least, of action on inclusionary zoning. Transportation, I wish they would do something in 2016, but they're not going to. We'll do our own thing in 2016 and wait for them to do something in 2017. So, by process of elimination, as well as by the fact that we've all declared it a priority and we're doing a lot of things, it seems to me that it maybe doesn't even have to be one of two. It might be the number one. And we say, this is the one thing we want out of this session. There's some other things that would be helpful, but this one, we might be able to be that definitive.
I would just ask you all to think about it and not answer it now, but do we want to take, if offered, a Portland-only lifting of the preemption? So that's something to think about. Yeah, okay. You're not thinking about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Portland-only or Portland-included? So one note I just want to make on that, and there is a bit of a sensitivity that the coalition who was really pushing inclusionary zoning was a statewide coalition last session, and we had a compelling testimony from a lot of parts of the state, especially on the for sale piece, about how that piece is more important to them, frankly, than it is to us. But it's also good to know how much latitude we have in trying to construct a bill that meets sort of Portland's housing needs as well. We will have to sort of negotiate some of those changes in statewide dynamics. Some of it may be to ultimately get a bill in the end.
Well, that's where, as a former occupant of this building, Mike Lindbergh always used to say, the facts are friendly. I don't want to abandon our allies, but speaking of facts, I think there are facts about multifamily inclusionary zoning mechanisms that have worked, that have delivered a lot more than 3% of the market as affordable, and been bearable in the economic costs of delivering those units for the developers who are being burdened, right? I don't know, there may, aside from the ideological fight with the home builders, I don't know if there have been successful low density single family inclusionary zoning schemes. I frankly doubt it, because in terms of, I used to work in that industry, if you're gonna build a new subdivision, it still costs what it costs to put in infrastructure and streets and all the rest. And to be able to deliver an affordable single-family product in a new subdivision, regardless of a governmental mandate, I'm just not sure how real that is. Now, again, I don't know. This is my ignorance talking here. I just don't know if Montgomery County or Salt Lake or Orange County or who has a successful, in terms of delivering a substantial percentage of affordable units in a marketplace that's capable of bearing the load. I don't know if that model is out there or not. I know that maybe there are people in Lynn County that wish such a thing existed.
Testimony last session about a county, I believe it's Northern California. Very good presentation by Opal about
actually working.
Inclusionary zoning, yeah. Yeah, so there are examples.
Well, the other things we can do are in the zoning for multifamily in the comp plan that it's contingent on if you do X.
Yeah.
And then for single family, we could do something in the zoning code saying that you get extra density for houses that are half the size and the lot is half the size of the largest in the subdivision. That's not inclusionary zoning. That's
zoning.
That's zoning and getting variety in subdivisions.
Yeah.
We proposed that 20 years ago. It didn't work. We didn't get it passed, but we could do it this go-around quite easily.
So on priorities and sub-priorities, one question I have for Martha and her team is I think there's going to be a lot of excitement about minimum wage issues in this session, and income relates to affordability as well as prices. So I wonder if it might sort of position us well to say, have us be running with the zeitgeist to say our two priorities are inclusionary zoning and minimum wage. I mean, that's a sort of a tactical question. I also just wanted to mention two other smaller priorities, which is if we, I agree with the mayor that we're probably not going to have a big climate push in 2016, but there's a group, including Oregon Environmental Council, that's circulating a healthy climate bill. And I think it's worth at least looking at that and seeing if it's something we could voice support for, even if it's not something we're going to devote tons of resources for based on, you know, viability. There's also, I've heard tell that the fire chiefs are putting together a proposal to make it easier for fire bureaus to be reimbursed by Medicaid for the medical care we provide, which is something that Commissioner Saltzman has been talking about for quite some time. So my understanding is their bill isn't actually ready yet, but if they put something together that's reasonable, I would hope that we could adopt that as a smaller priority.
Great. Thanks very much, Commissioner Novick. One thing that your comments point out is we still haven't made it off page one of our draft agenda. And what I might suggest, and noted on the GMT bill, we will absolutely review that when the draft comes available and share that with council if you want to include it in the final draft that comes before you in January. Maybe I'll just sort of summarize what we heard for housing. Obviously, we have an entire council that wants to go big on housing. Inclusionary zoning is one of those things that we can do a big push for. I also don't want to understate the importance of a couple of these items. I think they're actually going to keep us quite busy, especially the defending your ordinances. There is a bill that is actually going to expand what Portland did statewide and maybe even be more expansive. So how we negotiate some of those things, I think, will be really important in the 16 session. But maybe with you on the renter protections. So maybe with your permission, we can kind of quickly tick through the other items and then come back and see if we have the universe captured appropriately.
So page two of the agenda touches on climate change, and to Commissioner Novick's comment about the healthy climate bill, this draft priority supports that legislation, which would address climate change through reducing and capping carbon pollution. Environmental advocates are pushing for a cap and invest strategy that would meet our Oregon's climate pollution reduction goals of 75% below the 1990 level by 2050. This approach is geared at capturing the true cost of carbon pollution in a way that's cost-effective in promoting clean air, healthy communities. And it is in line with Portland's work over the past 20-plus years to reduce our carbon footprint and advance a low-carbon economy. Turning to the next page, minimum wage, we touched on this briefly before. It's similar to what Council supported in 15 as a policy position, and this priority simply states that support legislation to raise the minimum wage and lift the preemption on local governments to do both those things.
Do we know what the number is likely to be at the state level?
We don't have.
Actually, let me just jump in there. What we've heard House leadership say is they want to use the ballot measure of 1350 and lifting the preemption as a starting point. That's what they're looking at when they're having negotiations now. And so they want to say that's where we're going to begin, and let's see where we get during the session.
So just recalling and reminding everybody that we have this issue with parks workers, and that adding an additional minimum wage on the 2,000 seasonal workers would cause even more pressure on our own budget. So be careful what you wish for.
The next priority on our list is a perennial priority on our agenda, which is protecting against preemptions on local government authority. We discussed briefly construction excise taxes. That's kind of the main one we see, although we list a couple of others here as well. But it's similar to something that we have on our agenda every year.
So you pay us to be paranoid, and we are. You know, the last session, I was surprised how much pushback came on the paid sick leave bill and how many issues that got drawn into that in order to get the sick leave bill through the Senate. And it started out as the preemption conversation was extremely broad. The Senate proposed a bill that would have preempted the city of Portland in all areas of employment, which would have preempted our civil rights ordinance, which has all kinds of implications for people who live here who don't have protections. So the reason that we're paranoid about preemption is that we have people like members of, in some cases, our business community who actually go to Salem and say that the city of Portland should be preempted in these areas. I think construction excise tax, I think tenant protection, some of these areas where the city council, anywhere where you've gone on a limb and led, are things where we could be fighting back a preemption, both as a matter of local politics and, frankly, as a matter of national politics. The national group ALEC feeds these standardized preemption bills. In fact, Elizabeth and I are heading to D.C. This weekend for a workshop on Monday in D.C. on how to fight back some of this national preemption work. So we never know what exactly it's going to be. I was surprised at the breadth of what they tried to attach to the sick leave bill. Ultimately, they were not successful and had a very narrow 2-year preemption just on flexible schedules. So we haven't been hearing about anything except for construction excise tax and maybe something on the housing front, but we also have to maintain sort of rigorous opposition.
Okay, on to recreational marijuana, which is actually an area where we could have to fight back preemptions depending on what gets introduced. But we expect the Joint Marijuana Committee to introduce another omnibus bill to address mostly technical issues from Measure 91 and its implementing legislation. And we've been working with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the OLCC, and other local governments to address the process by which applicants for recreational licenses obtain land use compatibility statements. And under the current law, the OLCC requests the land use compatibility statement from the local government after the applicant has applied to obtain a recreational license. And what we're advocating for is to flip the process around so that the applicant comes to the local government first to obtain the land use compatibility statement so that they know that their business location is zoned appropriately, and then they take that to with their application packet and apply to the OLCC.
So our transportation funding and safety priority is really about laying the groundwork for 17 and says as much. So coming into 16, eyes open, and starting a really important conversation about getting a bill ready that has significant investments for maintenance, safety, and critical infrastructure, because quite frankly, the bill in 15 was not going to get us there. It was not big enough. This priority also talks about diversifying funding streams, especially those that increase local control, and calls out specifically vehicle registration fees for local governments. And so really it's about diversifying our resources and increasing our resources, because as we know, if the federal government comes up big, state government comes up big, and we come up big, we're still going to be short when it comes to transportation payments.
Actually, Elizabeth, counties are already allowed to do vehicle registration fees, which say such as city vehicle registration fees specifically. That's their issue.
I'll make that change. And I'll turn it over to Ariel Nelson, our associate, to talk about support for Umpqua Community College.
Good morning. For the record, Ariel Nelson, Office of Government Relations. Our state suffered a tragic loss when a mass shooting occurred on the campus of Umpqua Community College outside of Roseburg this October. As part of the statewide outpouring of support, stakeholders in the state legislature are developing and building support for a two-part legislative funding ask for new classrooms and for continued on-campus counseling and mental health care for the UCC community. This priority continues Portland's traditional advocacy for both rural communities and improving mental health care.
So that that wraps up our presentation, and again, open up for any sort of additional thoughts or questions, items that may not be reflected on here.
Martha, can I just put a, since we have this opportunity, can I plant a seed for the 2017?
Yes, please do.
So recently, I was with the governor, and when we celebrated the 100th episode of Grimm, and I've never seen the governor so animated in one of her speeches. And one of the things that
that she harped on and was seemed very focused on was that her economic development office had determined that the five-year impact to the state economy was about $250 million. And that they sent from Grimm. So the statewide economic impact was $250 million. And Senator Burdick was there. A lot of the legislative leaders that have to pass on things like what we did last time, SB 799, the credit sunset, and then the SB 872 and HB 2072, which would have put additional dollars into the program. They were there. And I got the impression from the governor's staff, Tim Williams, and some of the leadership was there, that there may be a willingness in the next session to rethink how we support film and television. And as you know, one of the challenges is it gets scored against all the other tax credits. And then when tough decisions are made, the best we could do is extend the sunset, not put additional dollars. But given that film and TV, film and video in particular, is having such a great impact on our state and locally, I'd like to work with the council and you in the next year to figure out a way to come in the next session with a bigger ask. Because I think folks are doing a very good job documenting the economic impact. And it may be that there are tools beyond a tax credit that the legislature would be willing to consider. After all, the alternative would be just general fund dollars. And I mean, it doesn't matter how it's funded. It's just currently we get scored against tax credit programs, and it doesn't work to our benefit. So perhaps early on we could engage State Office of Film and our allies on this, local and state, because a lot of them are shot here or in the region, like the librarians, which is in Clackamas, but is filmed here a lot. And I hope this is something we can make a priority the next session.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. And let me just say that it's absolutely not too early to start thinking about the 2017 session. So as I really appreciate the feedback to help put things on our radar, because we can absolutely start laying groundwork for 17. In some cases, we'll have an opportunity to participate in informational interviews, which really are informational hearings at the end of the 2016 session, which really do help frame what the 17th session will look like. So thank you for that suggestion.
One of the other things that I'm interested in for 2017, which you and I discussed yesterday, is an issue of vehicle insurance and the minimum not having been raised for a long time. And as part of that discussion, you said that Senator Shields might be bringing something on insurance. Did you have a moment to be able to find out about that?
I tried to contact his staff yesterday, but wasn't able to reach anybody. But I will definitely follow up with you in short order.
Thanks. So before the actual council hearing, we may be able to get some more information to the rest of the council on that, because that's something that my understanding is that would be coming in the short session, and something that I'm very interested in supporting.
About inclusionary zoning to help us, I think, take the approach that Commissioner Fish has suggested of having that be the very highest of our priorities. If it is one of one or two or one standing above the rest, either way, I think you've got a council that wants to really work on that issue. So keep us posted even before. Obviously, you call on us during the session to be down there. This is one where, to take your point, Nick, we should be having this conversation, some of which you've already started. Now, so that we build that momentum.
Great. Thanks so much, Mayor and Commissioners. We will make those changes in the drafts. We'll circulate redrafts the middle of this month, and then we will work to get on the council agenda for early January. We'll also work to schedule a legislative breakfast again with our delegation. The breakfast last year, I think, was very successful. We had great turnout, and I think it's a great jumping-off point for the February session. And I just would like to conclude by thanking each of you and your respective staffs for your leadership. It's so great to have a council that's so engaged in our federal and state legislative efforts. It really is a great reason why we're successful as a city. So thank you.
Thank you very much.